250 years later, what is the state of the American dream? A new novel examines the history of birth control in early 20th century Arkansas, and more on what shifting tornado patterns mean for us in the natural state. Those stories and more are coming up this week on the News Wrap from the Arkansas Newsroom. I'm Daniel Breen, News Director of Little Rock Public Radio. Each week, we're recapping the top stories from all across the natural state. We'll unpack the headlines, share exclusive insights, and provide the context you need to fully grasp the issues that matter most to Arkansans. That's this week on the Arkansas News Wrap, coming up right after the news from NPR. This is the Arkansas News Wrap. I'm Daniel Breen with Little Rock Public Radio. As America gears up to celebrate 250 years, there's also a growing number of protests against the current administration and calls for the country to reckon with its troubled past. Little Rock Public Radio's Kaya Pennington has more.
The American dream can mean many things to many people. Land ownership, prosperity, freedom, and for some, it can mean nothing.
I don't believe in an American dream.
That's Courtney Maxwell speaking at a March for Democracy demonstration sponsored by the People's Protests of Arkansas.
I think that we are raised to believe that you can come here as an immigrant and you can go about it the right way. And during all of this, I have really learned that it doesn't matter how you do it. They still don't like immigrants. The rich run and own everything.
The demonstration, held March 3rd at the Arkansas State Capitol, saw many Arkansans join in. Danina Llewellyn was another marcher who says she protests as a way of exercising her rights.
I think if you don't, you're saying that you agree with it. I think this is our way of saying we disagree. And I think enough of us do it, we get seen.
The American Dream is a concept first mentioned by author James Truslow Adams in his 1931 book, The Epic of America. He said the American Dream represents that dream of a land in which life should be better, richer, and fuller for everyone, with opportunity for each according to ability or achievement. UA Little Rock history professor Barclay Key says the American Dream has changed from the original meaning.
But it sort of represents a culmination of ideas about what it means to be an American, encapsulated in this phrase that would later be used by companies in their ads. We want to sell stuff. The American Dream means being a consumer of stuff.
Popularity of the phrase would take off in the midst of the Cold Wars. Key says this dream includes notions of freedom for oneself and one's family, and as long as one has that, everything is going to be okay. And above all, if one just works hard enough, they can make it, whatever that looks like for them. But historically, this just wasn't a dream afforded to all. In the 1857 case of Dred Scott versus Sanford, the Supreme Court upheld the ruling that Black Americans were more property than citizens. Just over a decade later, the 14th Amendment upheld that anyone born in the U.S. was a citizen. Before, groups like enslaved African Americans were still barred from citizenship even after slavery was abolished in 1865. Despite new political, social, and economic opportunities for minorities, Professor Key says this doesn't automatically erase centuries of prejudice. Black Americans may have been freed citizens, but were still subject to harsh segregation laws. And these laws also extended to other racial minorities, like Chinese immigrants. In the 1927 case of Gong Lum versus Rice, the Supreme Court upheld the ruling that Chinese Americans in Mississippi were not allowed to attend white schools.
And so I say all that to say that as with most things, if not all things, the opportunities that are present for citizens of the United States have varied tremendously based on a person's location and the color of their skin.
Arkansas's legacy is blemished too. The state has as much land as it does, in part due to the forced removal of some 60,000 Native Americans through the Trail of Tears. The Elaine Massacre of 1919 is considered Arkansas's deadliest racial conflict after an estimated 25 to 200 Black residents lost their lives when a mob of 500 to 1,000 white residents stormed the town. The Negro Boys Industrial School's lack of proper attention will lead to a fire just outside of Riceville in 1959 that left 21 boys dead. In 2026, some see the Trump administration's militant use of immigration and customs enforcement as a stark reminder of the past and another way to cut off minorities from the American dream. George Ferguson started protesting the Trump administration back in 2016. Now he spends his time protesting Little Rock's ICE detention center near the airport. Most weekday afternoons, he stands outside the unmarked building with signs to demonstrate his disapproval of the agents holding immigrants for further transportation. While he says he has stayed out in the rain alone to protest, he more often is joined by at least five other people, and sometimes more, depending on the day.
And every day, they bring out people they've picked up the day before from this building in shackles, and they put them in huge vans with no windows and take them to the Louisiana ICE Detention Center. So we're out here to wait for those vans to arrive, and then we protest the actual bringing out of people in shackles.
A February 2026 PBS News NPR Marist poll found that 62% of Americans feel the actions of ICE make America less safe. Ferguson says protesting keeps his hope alive.
Do I think in the moment it stops anything? No. Accumulatively, I think it has an effect, because there are also all the people driving past who, if nothing else, have to think about what they just read. They may reject it, but they can't not see it.
At that same March for Democracy demonstration, protester Danina Llewellyn says she suffered familial and social consequences for protesting.
Our political views have cost us pretty much all of our family and most of our friends. We've made new friends.
And these marches are just one form of protests. Artist Jose Hernandez, in collaboration with Arkansas Peace Week, has turned the 7th Street Underpass in Little Rock into a thriving hub for creativity and social commentary. The 7th Street mural features artwork like an American flag with a caption, "The United Voices of America," and in a red, white, and blue thought bubble, "An attack against one is an attack on all." Hernandez says the project started in 2020 as a response to the murder of George Floyd.
We went out there and painted as a protest. I'm a painter, you know, I do murals, so that's my platform, and that's how I know how to express myself as an artist.
Hernandez says he came to the U.S. in the late 2000s searching for the American dream, but now no longer knows what it means. He now worries about the impacts of increased ICE presence in the country.
I mean, it totally affects me. Travel, you know, like not knowing if I'm going to be able to travel anywhere in the States, if I'm going to be subject to ICE, or my family members are going to be subject to ICE. If I can't go out of the country, I don't know if I'm going to be able to come back because of my beliefs or what I've supported in the past. You know, there's so much fear installed now to try to control what we do, what we don't do.
It was the same feeling of powerlessness, Hernandez recalls, that led to the George Floyd mural. He wanted to create something that would spark critical thought and unity.
And then that snowballed into like having the whole city behind us during the protest. The protesters went down there and celebrated together. So unified, it was a way to bring the city together.
Across these movements, protesters shared a common theme. They see their work as an act of patriotism despite a divided political climate. Here's Maxwell, Llewellyn, and Ferguson again.
I think that it would be unpatriotic to not be out here. I think it would be unpatriotic to not stand up for all people in the U.S. What we're marching for is democracy, and if you're not going to march for democracy, that's unpatriotic to me.
Look, American flag right there, you know? We're proud of who we are. We just want it to be better.
So if we fight now to prevent it from being destroyed, they can join in with one another from all races, from all social economic classes, from all gender identities, to maintain hope and dreams for the country that really has been the biggest example of that in the world history.
Much like Ferguson, Hernandez acknowledges that not everyone is going to agree with what they were doing, but that's why it's worth doing.
And then they had like some kind of like alternative right thing going on downtown at the Capitol. There was some kind of vandalism done to the murals. It was swastikas, or just like straight up just whitewashed messages, like literally white paint over faces and messages. But we're there the next day painting it, fixing it, adding a new mural, because our message is going to be bigger and stronger every time they come out there.
When James Truslow Adams coined the phrase the American dream, he described a life of equality in work, life, and all other aspects. You were meant to be judged not by what you have, but by who you are as a person. Historically, the American reality for a lot of minority groups has not been this. Equality has been fought for. And if you ask these protesters how they see themselves, they are campaigners in hope of a better future for their families. So the American dream, however disillusioned by it they may be, is still a central ideal in their protests. Perhaps the American dream and the American reality aren't so far removed from each other. After all, a flicker of the American dream can still exist in the grimmest moments of the American reality. So perhaps they are two sides of the same 250-year-old coin.
That was Little Rock Public Radio's Kaya Pennington reporting. A new novel looks at the history of birth control in the U.S. through the lens of a fictional 17-year-old girl growing up in 1930s Arkansas. Covered Buttons is the debut novel from Stephanie Saunders, a North Arkansas native and professor of Spanish at Lyon College in Batesville. I caught up with Saunders to learn more.
I started this story over a decade ago, started writing the novel. It really inspired by my grandmother's stories that she grew up during that time period. And using a lot of those same research techniques that I would with my academic work, I came across just like a rich amount of research done on the birth control movement in the state in the 30s. And I was super, super intrigued.
And tell us a little bit about your novel's title, Covered Buttons. What does that represent?
It refers to the textile imagery and some of the folklore in the book that has to do with buttons, and actually some of the exchanges of messages that were taking place between the characters. So this is it's a coming of age novel. It's set in 1939 Arkansas, and it follows 17-year-old Thea, who's been helping her father raise her two-year-old brother. And so she finds herself basically at a crossroads of what's next in life. She's watching her friends get married, start families of their own, and suddenly she comes into contact with a group of women that really give her new ideas for independence and education. The first birth control clinic opened in Arkansas in 1931. This was basically the diaphragm was what the method was. And those that were eligible for birth control needed to come into the clinic and be fitted for that device.
And how was birth control viewed both in legal and medical circles and really just in the mind of the general public in the 1930s in Arkansas?
Yeah, that's a great question. So there at that time, there was a law that was set into place, the Comstock Act, that did not allow the mailing of information about contraception. So it was really very much of a taboo. It was legal, but it was illegal to disperse that information. And so that was not overturned until 1936. So you can imagine that there was lots of really wives' tales floating around, you know, about how to plan one's family to prevent further pregnancies and that kind of thing, which were not always, you know, accurate, of course. And so this network of Little Rock Club women were really working to help with the education, help with the opportunities for these women, and change public perspective on this too.
And that was one thing that surprised me, was that birth control was technically legal, or was maybe in a gray area, but the information, just letting people know about it, was illegal and was so guarded and gatekept, for lack of a better word.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, it certainly takes a long time for that perception to change. And so, you know, when I was putting together this novel and rewriting it over the years, that was something I really grappled with, because I was wondering if, you know, someone in my own family from rural Arkansas, where, you know, like live 3 hours away, like how would they even know about it? How would they get there? And so that's how one of my protagonists was born, basically, how she came about trying to bridge those gaps.
And so your novel delves into this, I think you call it a quiet network of support of mainly women who were seeking to educate other women about birth control back in the 1930s. How did that network function? What did it look like? Who was in it? And how would someone who needed it access it?
Yeah, absolutely. So Hilda Cornish, she was the daughter of German immigrants. She was the one that really spearheaded this in the early 30s and helped to organize. And she got together ministers from local churches, you know, lawyers. There was a rabbi that was included. So really tried to connect the community. And so that network at the beginning, it was all on a volunteer basis. So the clinic had very limited hours. It was under a couple hours a week. And the women that worked there and the physicians were all volunteers. And so for the women to come in to make an appointment and get access, they needed to check a number of boxes. They needed to be married, be under a certain economic level, which that was pretty easy to meet because at that time in our state, the yearly salary was about half of what it was in the rest of the United States. So there was a time of poverty, or it could also be what with a number of medical conditions. So when I was doing this research, I came across the work of a historian that she's based in Tennessee. Her name is Dr. Marianne Luong, and she had written her dissertation and a couple of book chapters about this. And she included in that the authentic letters of women that were seeking help. And these letters, they are absolutely heart-wrenching, you know, of them pouring out their souls and saying, you know, I'm married, I've got two or three kids, we're having trouble feeding the ones that we have, you know, we need help planning our family. And so how can we get that support? So, and in some instances it was, you know, like health concerns, that disease uterus, there was that kind of terminology. And they were told, you know, don't have any more children, but they weren't told how to prevent either. So.
And one thing about this story that stuck out to me was how the women involved in this viewed the sort of the role of community support and getting buy-in, avoiding controversy, sort of treating it as something separate from quote unquote radical feminism. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, that's a great point. Yeah, the women were really working into with the norms of society at that time. So it wasn't something where they were saying, you know, don't have children and go, you know, it, by any means. It was something of just really helping the women. They themselves had their own families, were mothers and wives, and they really believed in the plight of healthier mothers and healthier babies. And so that's what they were setting out for.
And, you know, reading this story and looking at the history of it, one can't really help but draw parallels to the present day and debates over contraception and birth control and just women's health in general. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think it's a timely story. You know, I've been surprised in the last few years, some of these, for example, there was a reference to the Comstock Act in a major publication, a major newspaper in the U.S. a few years ago, not even a few, a couple. And so it's something that it feels like that in some ways, some of these issues have come full circle, you know, with right around, we're right about the 100-year mark, you know, and I still see a number of women working tirelessly for the healthcare and opportunities of women in throughout the state, throughout the nation. And so I'm hopeful that for me, this is a story of hope, and I hope it's one that the readers feel that as well.
That was author and professor Stephanie Saunders talking about her new novel, Covered Buttons. The novel, published by Mercer University Press, is out now. Tornado Alley is shifting eastward. That's according to trends from the National Weather Service and a recent study from Northern Illinois University. Rachel Brennan covers insurance for U.S. News and World Report and says tornadoes and other severe weather caused about $68 billion worth of damage last year. She tells KUAF's Daniel Carruth that extreme droughts in the southwestern U.S. are pushing these storm patterns eastward to more densely populated areas, causing problems for homeowners.
We're seeing premiums increase because of the increased number of claims. And we're seeing that the homes that were built in these areas are not necessarily built to withstand regular tornado exposure. And so there's a lot more manufactured homes and homes that are not designed to handle this kind of windstorm. And so they're seeing a lot more damage, and that's causing insurance costs to go up in the area.
Yeah. And I mean, can you talk a little bit more about those like added risks for homeowners or even like cities and municipalities where the infrastructure maybe isn't resilient to this type of storms? Like it just hasn't been built with the thought of these storms in mind, and what those risks are.
Well, the risks are generally that you're going to see significant roof damage, significant glass damage, and homes that are not secured on a foundation are going to be at significant risk of the actual home itself toppling or being ripped apart in the process of a storm. And the things that people can do that are helpful in these situations, making sure they have appropriate storm shutters, making sure that they have a solid foundation, removing like dead trees and other debris from the yard so that it does not get slammed into the house and cause excessive damage. There are steps that you can take to protect your home and prevent like these high insurance claims from happening. But just the presence of these storms and the increased number of these storms in this area mean that homeowners are filing more claims. And so insurance companies are raising the rates to account for the increased risk. The most important thing is to review your declarations page of your insurance policy and check the perils section and make sure that windstorm and hail and, you know, that sort of thing are listed as covered and are not listed as an exclusion, because a lot of the insurance companies in these areas are now removing coverage for windstorms completely and making you purchase it as a separate endorsement to your policy. And the other thing is that if you do have this coverage, you need to check your deductibles, because a lot of insurance companies have moved away from a flat fee deductible for wind damage claims and have moved to a percentage-based deductible. So instead of paying $1,000 to repair a totaled home, like if your home is completely damaged, you may have to pay 2% or 5% of the total cost of repair under your windstorm coverage.
And then as far as other proactive tips or things people should do going forward, I mean, how can people be proactive and be prepared for these future storms, especially as they become more prevalent in some of these areas?
Well, for proactive planning, the very best thing that you can do is take your phone and walk through every room and take a video. Open the drawers, narrate what you're seeing, look in your closet, and talk about the condition that the articles are in, and then upload a video to the cloud. Because if your property is damaged in the process of a tornado or other storm, you need proof to show to your insurance company what it is that you are replacing and what condition it's in, so that they know to have the most accurate information when they're paying out your claim. And then in addition, you're going to want to keep digital copies of your ID and your deed, your insurance policy, all of that in a password-protected cloud folder so that it's not lost in the storm.
That was Rachel Brennan, insurance reporter for U.S. News and World Report, speaking with KUAF's Daniel Carruth. And that's it for this week. The Arkansas News Wrap is brought to you by the Arkansas Newsroom, a collaboration between KUAF in Fayetteville, KASU in Jonesboro, and Little Rock Public Radio. You can find this week's episode on any of our station's websites. Until next time, I'm Daniel Breen, and this is the Arkansas News Wrap.